Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
I hope you're still all ticking along okay and surviving the massive changes that are underway. Because it's in the air, you feel it. I always go by the observations of authors down through time, basically. And some of them, like H.G. Wells, the work for the big system, of course, he did say that when World War II was coming along, he said it was in the air. You could feel it. Everybody could feel it. And you get these senses of change. It's almost like you suspect there's whispering going on somewhere. Or you might you don't hear it, but you suspect it's around you somewhere. It's almost like that kind of feeling you get when the big changes are happening. Because we move through life now in planned stages. And these stages are really, really incredibly well planned. We've got to stop having children. At least all of you, right? There's different categories of who should stop having children. It's never ending. It's pretty ceaseless, isn't it? A long term, all the way from Malthus to the present. Same stuff. And the ones who tell you, it's not them. It's you that's not to have children. H.G. Wells was quite blunt about it. And he was an awful snob, even though he came from a lower background, really. He went through a good schooling because his mother was really a housekeeper for a very rich family. His dad was a drunk. Awful drunk. He couldn't keep a job. He used to get part-time work as a cricketer for a cricket team, you know. But I can remember reading the H.G. Wells would look at all these people going past the windows with the big houses every morning on the way to their factories at the time. They used to have actual work at those days and had factories and so on. They didn't give it all away. It petrified them to think that they're only a little stone throw from joining them. So he began to despise the working people. He did. And that's why he became almost a control freak in his writings, portrayed that too, especially his non-fiction writings. And he was a co-founder of the Fabian Society, funded by the Astor family. It's amazing how the rich, again, technocrats and transhumanists of the day fund all these organizations. It's not a recent thing. It's interesting, isn't it? And it shapes directions of the future. It just even shapes the directions of wars and things are going to have. And what they'll get out of it, etc. Social and economic wise. So anyway, H.G. Wells said, well, what happens? He says, look at the people who are poor, he says. He says, well, what happens? You help, you give them better sanitation, you know. And teach them hygiene and give them hygienic products and so on, and give them a bit more money to feed themselves. Eh? He says, and then you help prevent them from getting diseases. And what do they do? He says they breed. He was disgusted. They breed. Yeah, all of them. They breed. Yeah. You know, at one time that would have shocked people. I think we're so dumbed down today that the most folk can't be shocked anymore. And that's a dangerous time to live in when folk can't be shocked anymore. But we're living in a war. This is a war, folks. It really is for everything, every part of the future. Worse than any other war we've ever had before. The scientific tyranny that Bertrand Russell said that he would endorse and he hoped out of all the tyrannies for the future. You know, but like the basic fascist type, the basic communist type or whatever, he said, of all the tyrannies, I would prefer it be a scientific one. Well, that's what you're under. Science is the cover for all. And here's something too. I gave a talk, this talk years and years and back in the 90s. Don't knock something that protected peasants for centuries. And I'll say, well, it was your religions. Oh, we've seen the movies. I'm not talking about movies. I'm talking about real history, real things that happened. Eh? The movies were poison to make sure that it was poisoned in your mind forever and ever. Eh? religion was a big nuisance. And you read the tyrants that were promoting this system are in now, like H.G. Wells and all his non-fiction books. And he said it. He says, we've got to destroy religion. Same as the communists, they've got a lot in common. You can see how it all ties together with the same group that Quigley was talking about. We have them all, tyrants and fascists and communists and communists and blah, 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 blah. Dictators and so on. Because you see, the CFR and Royal Institute for International Affairs is all about rulership and keeping command over millions of people. And they financed, yeah, they financed, there's no doubt about it, they financed, helped to finance the communist revolution or the Bolshevik revolution. And they studied it, and Quigley said too, they were fascinated to see how it would work out, a big experiment. Oh, that was an experiment to them. And the same thing with Germany, Nazi Germany. They were all for it for years. They thought, this is terrific, you know, how everybody obeys them, and they're all happy looking. Because the group that runs us want us all miserable, and it's hard to look happy, isn't it? So we don't get such good propaganda that they had back then. However, be it communist or fascist, and the present supposed atheistic scientific socialism system we're in today, they all have to destroy this basic idea of Christianity, especially for the West, because that's what they had mainly, was Christianity for an awful long time, many, many centuries. And however rulers wanted to rule, it always got in the way of their rulership, because you couldn't just go out there and slaughter people without some comeback from the church, at least, you know. And yeah, you always had corruption of all sides, blah, blah, blah. And even in England was pretty bad for it too, because it did have the noble families who ran everything. And some would go and become knights and go off to war for the king or whatever, and pillage and plunder and rape, all for the good of the king and the crown. And but other members of the family would get sent into the priesthood. They lived awfully well, and they were anything but saints. But that's how they ruled for an awful long time. However, there was this understanding of a god, you see, a god. Believe it or not, but a god got in the way so many times, always, as to what the elite could do to the people. And it became really bad. The church had to step up and interact and intercede on the people's behalf many times, you see. And they couldn't go the whole way of just mass slaughter at times against the public. So it was a double whammy. They were run by the same people generally, but they had a lot of ordinary priests come down from the lower ranks, and they had some compassion for the people too, obviously. And they didn't live any better than the people at that time. Often worse, in fact, some of them. But it gave the people something to stand up for them. And once they understood that, especially when education came in, basic education came in, even the 19th century, once folk understood what it was about, they could use that like a law. You had the law of God. See, the law of God is different from the laws that the scientific groups are pushing today. The law of a God gives you rights. That they can't just go in and change things because you've got rights. And it's fascinating to me as I stand back. I can stand back from everything and just watch it and analyze it. And they actually gave human life a value, a real value. Awfully important that. It was the very thing that Julian Huxley talked about demolishing, this idea of humans on a pedestal, feeling superior to other species on the planet. Says we have to bring down their expectation of what life has to offer and what life is for them, the human people, because he was going to go in to depopulate. That's what Julian Huxley was all about. He was a Bill Gates of his time and Planned Parenthood and the whole thing, you know. And he's no lover of the ordinary people at all. But God gets in the way. Even then, God got in the way at times. An awful nuisance. The communists talked about it, an awful nuisance, because again, they were ruled by expert rule, scientific socialism. And the people, if they'd been steeped in Eastern Orthodox traditions, were an awful nuisance at times, and stubborn, you see. And H.G. Wells said that. He said, if we eliminate the family unit, all the communist ideas, it's strange how all of this, it's only one group with British lords and all the rest of it involved in it, like Russell. And communist, all the, because it's one club, you see, with different branches and different names, all like different kinds of specialized sheepdogs, all bringing the world into the same big sheep pen. All the different factions and types of sheeps all in the same pen. That's what you do. And so they all said the same thing, that they'd have to demolish religion. And Wells was quite very straight about it. He says, that way, he said, then we, scientific socialists, wouldn't be governed. Just with his pal, of course, Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw, he said, then we can talk directly to each subject. So you wouldn't be a citizen, you'd be a subject. And just like the crown you're in Britain, you're a subject to the Queen. Yeah, and he said, you'll get instant obedience because they'll have no family stand up for them, like a little tribe, an extended family. Because the folk used to do that, used to get together and say, hey, that's enough of that, and stop it. Well, I can remember schools when they tried to push the more advanced sex education stuff, which usually, and it's been admitted to now, was to get to encourage the children into promiscuity so that they wouldn't bond as they grew up to a particular person and have marriage and have children. And that's all admitted to now, of course, as they boast about things which they denied forever. I can remember, you know, groups of parents. They got, the guys at that time too knew they were men, mind you. They weren't cowed with a generation of how bad they were and how they got the whole weight and guilt of the whole planet on them. Psychological warfare. They actually stood up against tyrants. And if any teacher, sometimes you get a teacher who was an absolute physical tyrant, male or female, it didn't matter. And they would take it out on some child. Some of the teachers would just pick someone. They'd have some special person they hated, and they would hammer them in the classrooms. And you would see the parents fly through those doors. I won't go any further, but that's where it used to be. So even that had to be eliminated too. Destroy the family unit. Most of the families today, they don't have a dads around now. And of course, most of the women just go along with every change that's pushed along in school. Well, you know. No. Of course it is. You have the have-nots, and then you have the minority of haves. You got a middle class that will last a little while longer, but eventually that will start getting flattened out and dying off too. It's not been dying off for a while. And you'll be back like ancient Egypt before you know it. Same system. And massive prostitution. You already have that everywhere too. Young kids getting dragged into it and drugged and so on, as you know. Not just in Britain, you have in Canada as well. I was checking out the papers just about the week, last week or two. I couldn't believe the same stories. Same stories. You could swap the photographs, everything, and the stories, and the drug gangs, etc., etc. But that's the mandate, isn't it? Obviously. Your masters who rule the world, who all agree on everything. And that's the key to it. It's this agreement, this pledge. They all must pledge to go on the same agenda. All what you think are your elected leaders, and you watch it happen. And they'll all stand up for each other, but they'll never tell the public the truth. You don't have a democracy. You never have had it. And it's in your face today as never before. Never, ever before. But see, with the corporations now, they're your feudal overlords, as Quigley said they would be. The arrogance, even from their lowly little psychopathic... What I'm saying is, this is the biggest problem they have at the moment. And they don't really see it as a problem yet, because the youngsters, even youngsters up to the age of 40 now, really, I've got so much entertainment and so much to distract them. And so even when they feel uneasy, there's a big hole in their lives. Even with all the fake friends they can get and internets and folk they'll never meet or see, or even know if they're real, because the sock puppets run a lot of the stuff too. But something's massively missing. And of course, what's missing is they don't have real lasting relationships. Because that's anathema. A lasting relationship could end up in a family. And a family is like a small tribe. And a small tribe can often link up in a nation with other small tribes of people, families, like they used to. And governments were always afraid of them. H.G. Wells talked about so eventually if they could destroy the family unit, then government could dictate straight down to you personally, and there'd be nobody to stand around you to help you or defend you. Stop thinking you're being freed as you take away all the old system that kept you all cohesive and together. Really, what you're seeing and what you have seen is your whole defense mechanism being stripped and destroyed and replaced with it's like ersatz coffee. It's not real stuff at all. You got all these fake stuffs to replace things which are very, very necessary and very real. You forget that these people who call themselves servants are supposed to serve you. But of course, in socialism, and that's why the elites and the wealth of this world picked socialism. Socialism was planned by high levels of the middle classes who literally looked around them at all the poor and despised them and were afraid of them and thought they'd come out and start planning societies for them. Yeah, there'd be some do-gooders amongst them, but there was a lot of them. H.G. Wells was one of them, who had fear and contempt for the working classes. The fear part was that when he saw them passing their windows, going to these smelly, rotten factories, dirty factories every day, he, like many, I suppose, had a fear of maybe something terrible could happen and he'd have to join them. So you end up loathing that which you fear, you see.
So I've been programmed all down through these years, but in some of the shows, they showed you something that was shown much, much earlier, and it came from an idea that did not come from H.G. Wells, but H.G. Wells wrote about it. And what he was doing was telling people, in a sense, that a small group of men already ruled the world in the early days of H.G. Wells and had done before he came along. And we know this is so from the writings of the funders, just like today, that there were foundations back then that had already funded the revolutionary societies and coordinated the different revolutionary societies in different countries across the whole of Europe and the Western world. Very wealthy people, often the same people, really descendants. We have the descendants today who own the foundations, who fund the non-governmental organizations that have taken over from these old revolutionary societies. But still, it's the same format. And in the Star Trek series, they often show you, as I say, a planet where three or four brains were hooked up together, maybe five brains, the elders, this kind of stuff. Wells talked about it too. He called it the world brain. And he talked about the world brain, how again, a small group. And he inferred basically that the time, through science, they would be timeless, ageless, deathless basically. They'd be immortal. But they could rule a world with all the wisdom of the world hooked up to this global brain. And then we see all that in the futurist articles, the same things coming out to do with the world brain, where everyone's going to get hooked into this world computer society, this new virtual reality, and we're going through a paradigm shift. I love that term, paradigm shift. And what you're going through today with the velvet glove off the fist, I might say, off the iron fist, the glove comes off, and they're using brute force and the threat of brute force to make everybody, to ensure that everybody just goes along with this new totalitarian phase, while they work out all the rest of the agenda of depopulation over a 50-year period to bring in the new phase, where all the ones that they've basically picked out through their DNA, etc., will be allowed to breed in the future after the year 2050 and go on a much smaller, more reduced population. But always remember, as they're hooked into this global mind, you might call it, always remember that the big boys themselves, like Charles Galton Darwin, who talked about things like this himself, he said, we, the elite, must never alter ourselves. We have to alter everyone else's ability for self-preservation. Because when the state is taking care of all the decision making, the people won't need self-preservative abilities. But the elite who are guiding the ship of Earth, we the elite, he said, must be natural, we must be wild, he said. So they will not chip themselves. In other words, you're looking at literally a complete takeover, not of just the world and its resources, but during the progress, the process of this, the taking over the minds of everyone who will work towards what they want before we're all killed off.
So the system we're living in is very, very fake. It's paper thin. It's even almost beyond paper thin today, in fact, with its facade. But I used to think about all of this many, many years ago when you looked at the system. I call it the system. And the system truly has been here for an awful, awful long time. It's quite simple, really. You have powerful people with powerful institutions that live on regardless of the generation into which you're born. They recruit, train, and retire, and recruit, train, and retire people all the time. And they can have their big goals there, too, for big changes for the future, which you live through right now, too. Everything is happening for change. It was planned a long, long before you were born, including the electronic systems as well. H.G. Wells worked for the big group, too, not just the Fabian Society, because they're all Institute for International Affairs, the Royal Society ran all that in that those days. Because you must always run all sides of everything. And Quigley also talked about the same thing, but H.G. Wells talked about the world brain. And he said that everybody will have access to all information across the whole planet. We'll all be linked into it somehow. They just seemed to know it was coming. And with enough money, that struck one of their beliefs, with enough money and training put into any particular area, they can direct the course of change. And that's why you have discoveries today. And why those discoveries are bought over immediately and owned. And if it won't sell them, they have accidents and things like that. That's how it really runs. Seriously.
The book I'd like to recommend to all your listeners is a book called The Shallows, How the Internet is Changing the Way We Think, Read and Remember by Nicholas Carr. It's a cheap book. It's an amazing read, and it goes through the history of reading and the internet and what it's doing to our little fragile minds. Mm-hmm. And I'll read a quick page from 108 in the book. This is from an article in 2005, but the Annual Review of Sociology. The recent changes in our reading habits suggest that the era of mass reading, book reading, was a brief anomaly in our intellectual history. We are now seeing such reading return to a former social base, a self-perpetuating minority that we now shall call the reading class. And I'll read another one. It's full of all quotes from nearly 100 years now, and here's a quote from 1889 in the Harper article by Edward Bellamy, the futurist Edward Bellamy. And in his article, he says, with their eyes shut, people would carry around tiny audio players called indispensables, which would contain all their books, newspapers, and magazines. Mothers, wrote Bellamy, would no longer have to make themselves hoarse telling children's bedtime stories on rainy days. Or to keep them out of mischief, the kids would all carry their own indispensables. And it's kind of funny, 100 years down the line, nearly everyone has an iPod or an MP3, keeping them quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'll read something else as well. This is from page 116 of the same book. When we go online, we enter an environment that promotes cursory reading, hurried and distracted thinking and superficial learning. It is possible to think deeply while surfing the net, just as it's possible to think shallowly while reading a book. But that's not the type of thinking the technology encourages or rewards. One thing is very clear. If, knowing what we know today about the brain's plasticity, you were to set out to invent a medium that would rewire our mental circuits as quickly and as thoroughly as possible, you would probably end up designing something that looks a lot like the internet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And It's just amazing to really see that the thing that most people hold in their hands now, it's been planned for 100, maybe not even 200 years at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. H.G. Wells also talked about the world brain, which would be a supercomputer, which would have all data on everything that people could be able to tap into. And he wrote that again in the early 1900s. So they knew where they were going with all of this. Of course, it's easy to do it. All you do is make sure all the funding for science is directed at the science that you want to be brought in. It's that easy. You don't give out grants and say, do what you want and find things out. You say, we want you to study on this particular path and come up with X, Y, Z, you know. And that's how you make sure that you can actually do it. So whatever you want will eventually be done with unlimited financing. Yeah.
When you look at the founding people of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, like the Astor family, these are the same family with their foundation that was also funding the Fabian Society. You go into the founders of the Fabian Society, and you have H.G. Wells, a propagandist again for this group. He was the one who coined the term in World War I to get young men enthused. Young men can be very idealistic when they think they're fighting for a just cause. And the slogan became, the war to end all wars. You couldn't get more idealistic than that. But Wells is also the man who dreamed up the idea, and Bernays would be very proud of him, and publicized it and got it through all the newspapers through the Royal Institute of International Affairs, or because of them, since they owned all the newspapers, that the young men who wouldn't join should be shamed into joining by their girlfriends and their fiancés, who would wear a white feather in their cap. That's good psychological warfare or manipulation. They understood propaganda perfectly well. And that's how our minds are controlled. Big money and planning goes into all culture creation. And there's nothing on the bookstores, on their shelves, that isn't authorized to be there. And as I said, you don't have to get UFOs. They thought, would the public really swallow the UFO thing? They tried, remember, many years ago with Orson Welles, the actor, who broadcast across America a play, basically, on an invasion from Mars. It's always Mars, the red planet. They love red for revolution. And the little green men joke is a Masonic joke because they talk about the green man. It means nothing about Martians whatsoever. But they really thought they could possibly convince the public, and they tried that experiment using the psychological division of our staff of Princeton University in conjunction with the CIA, the Pentagon, to convince the public this was really happening with the late night broadcast of the play of H.G. Wells's book. And what a coincidence to give Orson Welles the main lead in the radio. Now, a program. People actually went out, they panicked and tried to leave cities by the hundreds. Some people were killed during it. They believed it. Big psychological test to see if they can make the public believe anything. People were shooting at big water towers, thinking they were Martian ships. All documented. And then the government sent round people to study all these different areas to get all the effects, to see what happened for their data collection, to see if it worked effectively, to find out where the weak points were, and maybe to do it better the next time. But you don't need UFOs, a threat from outer space. And in every parliament in the 80s and back again today, they're screaming that we've got to protect ourselves against incoming meteorites. See, those changes from UFO to meteorites or comets, etc.
Remember, World War One was a big plan. H.G. Wells talked about it, Fabian Society, Bernard Shaw, many others.
talked about that their dream would get fulfilled through this war, this war to end all wars. They came out with these slogans, you see. And of course, it never was a bigger lie than that, the war to end all wars. But the war was to get everybody to their knees, to give up sovereignty. But out of it came the League of Nations. That was the beginning of it, of a world government. H.G. Wells talked about it openly. He wrote about it and said, this is our hope and dream come true. Now politicians are bureaucrats mainly. They really run governments, regardless of politicians. The bureaucrats are more important. They're technicians. They know their area, their field of expertise, and they run it. But he said that now the heads of those organizations can contact each other and work together and bypass the political system altogether. If you look at the Communist Party of America, I did talks years ago on how they use different groups to try to foment revolution. The Communist Party, I don't know if they still do it, but they probably do still churn out books from their printing presses in New York City. And I've got some here from the old days, you know, going way back. And everything, in fact, that was printed in Russia, they'd have English copies printed in New York and distributed from New York. And there was no shame on what they were doing and what their goals were, which is a complete eradication of the existing system. It's always the same thing, they tell you. To put themselves in charge, to rule you, you see. Not to make things happier or better for you, but to rule you properly, you see. Where you just jump to it. Like technocracy is awfully efficient. Get things done, experts rule, you obey, and there's a whole system in place to make sure you obey. What tyrant would not lust after that idea? I mean, that's what it's about, you see. But they always have to get the public on board. And see, the first casualty of war is the truth, always. So communism, of course, was going to make a workers' paradise. Eh? And give you it's always utopia. Everyone's going to be free or cheap or whatever. And it's nothing to do with the truth. But they're told this, by the way. I've got the old books, and that's to tell their operatives and organizers to promote this infantile projection of a happy utopia where everything's just wonderful and you all get whatever you want and blah, blah, blah. But the higher level groups are led in on the inner secrets, because the general public are despised by those above them, like a real class system. That's the truth of it, folks. Utterly despised. And they get into the real truths of, again, it's really technocracy, that whole system of technocracy, which is efficiency by a planned society run by experts. No democracy. There's no such thing as democratic voting or anything. And no parties, just the party. And that really is the idea behind it. And, of course, when it comes to everyone according to their needs, then if you're part of the upper strata of the Politburo, your needs are obviously greater because your brain power is greater. And so you should have a lot more of everything else. You know, it's wonderful. So that's the kind of stuff that they always push. But it's interesting to see the different levels of it's a secret society, really. You know, an outer propaganda for the general population. Yeah, the working person is going to get, you know, better wages. And then you get up to the next strata, and well, like George Bernard Shaw said, it says the working guy, because that's who they appealed to in the early 20th century, the working guy. Yeah. He's got a lot to learn, he says, he wants to bring more money home to his wife. He doesn't realize he probably won't have a wife. We're going to get her into the workforce too to serve the state, you see. Yeah. So he was cautioned to shut up a bit and go back to the primitive. Oh, yeah, it's all going to be utopia. And they tried in Germany big time too to get the revolution there. And they were so disappointed. The same people who bought it for the Soviet Union, for Russia, were trying to get revolutions all through World War One, and towards the end too. And they tried it, in fact, and it failed. But it didn't stop there. But there was, they had to change their tactics. And they wrote a lot about in the communist books that they were so disgusted by the working people of Germany. So disgusted that they because he says, why would the working people go and fight the working folk of other countries that still had this thing in them that would serve the state, this idea of the nation state and the people, instead of just joining the workers' revolution in the world? And that appealed to a lot of people, even after World War One, absolutely. Because why the heck were they throwing people, their whole nations together? But then you go into the writings from the Lord Alfred Milner group, they wanted world war. He says through world war and conflict, we should be able to bring the countries into a global system after you've weakened them all and be so sick of fighting. H.G. Wells was a propagandist of him. He talked about it quite openly in his books. So war was a necessary technique they would use to weaken people and to make them disgusted about their, and to make them question their value systems until they gave up and allowed themselves to be guided into a preordained new system, you see. It's never stopped. And the people at the top really are not doing it because they love you. Not in the least, they're Malthusian types. They're eugenicists. The Soviet system, really, when you really got into their own writings, you talk about a class system. Whoa. And the Bolsheviks hated the common people. And a lot of the Bolsheviks, remember, weren't even Russian. Hated them. So it's interesting to watch. Sometimes the descendants of revolutionaries, the great-grandchildren perhaps, doing the same thing in the streets and across the US, coming from the same sources. And Chicago is an example where a lot of them had books out. Some of their parents had books out who were revolutionaries in the 1960s in the States, and they put books out talking about their, and they love to put their memoirs out, you know, when they've raked in their millions of dollars, these communists, and talked about them being red diaper babies. That's a common expression they use. They were raised on communism, the idea of revolution. From myself, Alan Ward, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.